listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello and welcome to Football in Europe once again. I'm your host, Rob Daly. This is your weekly European football podcast. With me via Skype is Chris Parrott. Chris, what are we talking about this week?
Well, it's a busy weekend in Europe. Marcelo Bielsa is back, has a new job in France. The Dortmund yellow wall was closed. They played in front of a rather eerily quiet stadium. Messi bails Barcelona out, but there was a lot of cheering and a lot of booing, particularly for Andre Gomez. And we speak to Elliot Rothwell, who's a Turkish football expert. And one more, Simone Zaza has finally scored a goal.
He has for Valencia, who maybe have turned the corner. Let's get to this week's Rubens, Chris. This is where we give like a fact or stat that we found in the week. What have you come across?
Well, we'll speak about it a bit more later, but Kevin Gamero scored a 4:43 hat-trick, which seemed to me like a rather quick. So I had a quick look. It's the quickest La Liga hat-trick since Bebeto in 1995. So quickest La Liga hat-trick for 22 years.
So how long did he take to score that hat-trick?
4:43, which is, given that the other team has kicked off twice in that time, is immense.
I want to find that Mane hat-trick. Mane hat-trick, how quick was that? But Robbie Fowler's, and it took him... Oh, come on, Google.
Come on, Wikipedia.
How can you write an article about it and not have the time? 4 minutes... Oh, no, he scored his in 2:56.
2:56?
It was Aston Villa. It was a 6.
That's almost impossible.
All right, here's mine. I saw this on Football España. Granada made La Liga history at the weekend against Real Betis as they made a starting lineup consisting of 11 different nationalities.
Did they?
Name them all. No, don't do that. But like Ochoa was in goal from Mexico. They had Mubarak Quacasso of Ghana, Andreas Pereira of Brazil, and they managed to get the whole lot, and they won 4-1 against Real Betis.
Wow, that is that's quite impressive, isn't it? Did you see Barcelona only had one Spaniard in their starting 11, I think?
Did they? At the weekend?
Yeah, at the weekend, which is... you know, for a club that's seen so many great Spanish players, it seemed surprising. I think it was Sergio Roberto.
Oh, bizarre. Okay, well, we're going to talk a lot about Barcelona later on in the show because a lot's been going on at the Camp Nou since their heavy defeat to Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League. Speaking of French football, let's talk about Ligue 1, Chris, because Marcelo Bielsa is coming back to Europe. He's coming back to France, more specifically, because he's agreed to take over at Lille, but not quite yet. As in, the deal's done, but he won't be manager now.
No, he'll be manager for the start of next season. So El Loco, the crazy one, is back at Lille, which is an interesting move. Last seen really well in France anyway with Marseille, 2014-15. And then he had that amazing period when he took over as Lazio boss, but quit 2 days later because he thought he was going to get the Argentina job. I think that was right. Anyway, so he was there for 2 days. So he's resurfaced. He's a hero of Guardiola, hero of Pochettino. I think Lionel Messi's a huge fan as well. But I think in a way, because of that Lazio decision and the Marseille period, it sort of counted him out of very big jobs. So he's gone to Lille and, you know, it's a great move for Lille, but I also feel like for Bielsa, he's going to have to prove himself maybe a little bit again. He's a great coach, but do you know what I mean? Be at a club for maybe a couple of years before one of the big boys might come looking again.
Do you think it's a risky appointment? I saw that the Lyon president, Jean-Michel Aulas, who's fairly outspoken anyway, came out and said, "I'd never take Bielsa as a coach." And I suppose he does have this reputation now. I even think back to his Marseille departure at the start of 2015-16, where he just left on after the first game. Like, can you trust him to really, you know, they're giving him a 2-year deal. Can you really trust him to stick about and actually do the job?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I sort of think he has to prove to people that he can do. He has an interesting club in Lille, huge new stadium for Euro. won the title a couple of seasons ago, didn't they? They bought a lot of players in January, including Anwar El Ghazi from Ajax. So I think he's got the nucleus of quite an exciting team. And I guess from Lille's point of view, probably is worth the risk, because if you get a firing Bielsa, you've got one of the best coaches in European or world football. So I can see why they've done it. And again, it's just another exciting add, I think, to Ligue 1, which has been so boring for so long. Let's be honest, with Paris Saint-Germain running away with it. Now you have Nice, okay, they're faltering a bit. You have Monaco, you have Marseille with their cash, and maybe now you have Lille as well, with, in terms of their coach, a man who has achieved an awful lot in his career.
Well, the task for the job of keeping Lille in Ligue 1 for the rest of the season is Franck Passy, a former Bolton Wanderers midfielder. He's sort of in interim charge until the end of the season after Patrick Collot was dismissed after a really disastrous 2.5 months. Some of the quotes I've got, Chris, I've got some quotes about Bielsa. Do you want to hear them?
Please.
Okay, so this one from Guardiola. He said in 2012, when Bielsa got Athletic Bilbao to the Europa League final, "We are standing before the best coach the planet currently has. He's one of my idols." The Lille director, Marc Ingler, said Bielsa is undoubtedly one of the most respected and influential coaches in the world, and it's proof of our ambition at the club that we've been able to bring him. Iker Muniain, who played for him at Bilbao, was asked, "Is he really as mad as he portrayed?" And Muniain said, "No, he is madder."
Good quote, good quote.
And Javi Martinez famously said that he described him as insane at Bilbao, and that how he would just stay there into the early hours, just working. And when he arrived at Bilbao, he had watched all of the 38 previous season's league matches and made colour-coded spreadsheets to give to the players on their performances.
I mean, yeah, it's that type of intensity. You see it with Guardiola, don't you? I think they just get exhausted after a couple of seasons, because they're, you know, I wonder if it's that much fun. I mean, on the face of it, watching 38 games is great, but do you know what I mean? Is it, if you're that intense and that involved, I wonder how much enjoyment at that time you actually get. You probably look back and think that was a great time. But yeah, I mean, he's a very intense character, and Ligue 1 will be all the more better for him being back. It'll be great when Lille go to Marseille for the first time. I'm sure there'll be some banners. They were pretty upset when he left, despite the fact that he, as you said, one way of looking at it is he rather left him in the lurch, given when he left in the season. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think from Leo's point of view, sometimes opportunities are too good to turn down, I think. And if Marcelo Bielsa indicates that he's willing to come, I think you have to take that gamble.
Yeah, of course, linked with Swansea earlier on in the season as well, Bielsa. Mm. And everyone remembers when he sat on a cup of coffee. If you haven't seen that, when one of his assistants left a cup of coffee for him on an ice cooler, and Bielsa just sat down on the coffee, it's one of the best things you've ever seen. I was also looking up that Lille team again, Chris, just that won the title in 2011 when Rudy Garcia was the manager there, of course, now at Marseille. The team consisted of Eden Hazard, of course, who was eventually earned him that move to Chelsea, Idrissa Gueye, Mathieu Debuchy, Papa Suari, Gervinho, Moussa Sow, and Adil Rami.
Yeah, what, absolutely.
14th of the season, 4 points above Caen, who sit 18th in the relegation places after they beat them 1-0.
But remember that Lille, history-wise, for a long time, you know, the biggest club in Flanders, in that area of France, is Lens by a mile. And, you know, traditionally anyway, historically, Lille played in a fairly ramshackle stadium for a long time. They weren't in the top flight. And then all of a sudden, probably in the last decade, they've suddenly become a force again in French football. And, you know, it's a big cosmopolitan city, which I'm sure helps. But whilst they've gone up, Lens have sort of capitulated and currently in Ligue 2. So it's interesting, because I bet if you're a Lens fan, you're looking on thinking they've got Bielsa, who would almost be better suited to a Lens type team. But yeah, good on Lille. I think it's going to be entertaining, whatever happens.
Certainly will. They have to stay in Ligue 1, though, surely, for him to not back out of that deal. Paris Saint-Germain held at home by Toulouse 0-0 at the weekend. Monaco drew 1-1 at Bastia on Friday night ahead of facing Manchester City in the Champions League. Bernardo Silva with the goal. We're going to talk about the Champions League ties later on in the show. But Chris, something of a come down for Paris Saint-Germain after what I think was the best team performance I've seen from any team this season when they beat Barca 4-0.
They were immense, and it's a big missed opportunity because Monaco drew on Friday at Bastia away. They had to come from behind. So this was Paris Saint-Germain's opportunity to narrow the gap at home to Toulouse on Sunday. They didn't, 0-0. And it was back to their Ligue 1 displays. They clearly put in a huge amount of effort against Barcelona, and they were wonderful. And unfortunately, the players have set that bar now. And maybe something is slightly missing in Ligue 1. I don't know. What do you think to this? Because if as a club you get rid of Laurent Blanc and you say Champions League glory is our aim, that's why we're buying in Unai Emery, who's won 3 European trophies with Sevilla, does it almost give players an excuse not to be absolutely at it in Ligue 1? Because the club have almost said themselves, well, do you know what? Ligue 1, it's okay, but we want to win the Champions League. So maybe that explains why they're not always on it, or they haven't been this season.
Well, I'd point to Zlatan Ibrahimovic when you say that, because when he arrived, he stood under the Eiffel Tower famously saying, I want to win the Champions League. I've come here to win the Champions League with Paris Saint-Germain. And week in, week out, he delivered in the league. Like, he didn't let up. He set a standard that every game they were going to win this and we're going to be 30 points clear and then we're going to be in a European, quarterfinal and try and win it. And, they've obviously lost Ibrahimovic in a sense and a leader in the dressing room, and that guy who perhaps would pull them through a lot of those league games where you have to win 1-0, 2-0. And that's the standard they should be aiming for. There's no excuse for switching off. Their wage budget outstrips everyone else in that league.
That's why I read a couple of articles last season. They probably couldn't have afforded his wages, but I think Arsenal should have broken the bank to get him if that was a possibility. I don't know if it was, just because they smack of a team that needs someone like Ibra in it. It's just a winner. He doesn't, if he draws with Toulouse, he's furious for days. I don't think Arsenal have people like that in their dressing room. Manchester United definitely do, and they do because they've got Ibra. So, yeah, I think you're right with that. It's just interesting because that was a real chance to claw back some ground on Monaco after they a disappointing draw for Monaco at Bastia. But we can't take anything away from that demolition of Barca. It was, as much as Barca were poor, my word, Paris Saint-Germain were good, weren't they?
They were amazing. Nice, meanwhile, got a win against Lorient. They've had a slight dip since the turn of the year. Cyprien with the only goal of the game. But Balotelli got sent off into the second half. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the nature of his third red card of the season for Nice?
Yeah, and his second against Lorient. Got it for insulting the referee in English. absolutely. Tony Chaperon. You can't do that, Mario. Particularly can't do that when you're not playing well. And as you said, discipline now is a huge issue for Balotelli. I say for now. It has been his whole career, isn't it? But on the pitch now, it's becoming an issue. And, he's going to have missed a lot of games through suspension now.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll look to have him beyond this year, because some of the players, as we spoke about on a previous show, came out and criticised him a little bit. Favre had and has then been backing him since he's been dropped out of the team, says he has been working hard. And to be fair to Balotelli, one of those red cards was rightly rescinded earlier on in the season.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga Roundup.
Chris, do you want to talk Bundesliga very briefly?
Yeah, let's, because I mentioned this in the show, but Dortmund beat Wolfsburg, which, big win, given they haven't been great recently, have they? Certainly not results-wise. But the famous yellow wall was silent, owing to those very unsavoury scenes against Red Bull Leipzig. So how was it? Was it strange? It must have been, I guess. 25,000 standing terrace shut.
Yeah, it looked weird. It looked weird when you actually saw it on telly. I saw that officials from the club said afterwards it was like playing football without a ball. Like, they were just so not used to having that. But it made no difference for Dortmund getting that 3-0 win. I saw that Dortmund did apply to let children on the stand. And there were protests outside the Zud Tribuna ahead of kickoff as well, that people felt that they had been unfairly prosecuted for the actions of a minority, but there were banners like "Slaughter the Bulls" and something very derogatory at Ralf Rangnick, the sporting director of Leipzig. The German Football Association decided to come down hard on Dortmund, really send a message. I saw Gladbach actually, their supporter says they had a banner that said something like, "We're sorry for the, you know, because they played Leipzig, we're sorry for the rocks and things that didn't hit you," or something like that. I mean, it's just absolute hatred, Chris. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Banners are one thing, although not if they are, inciting violence or anything like that. But I think actions are that, you know, that's the reason that the wall has been tipping point. And it's not the first time, is it, that Dortmund fans have been involved in serious trouble this season. So, I unfortunately, the passion is one of the great things about watching football in Germany and particularly at Dortmund, but they're rather giving a very exciting young side a bad name, I think, with their actions.
Yeah, and a big win elsewhere in the Bundesliga this week for Werder Bremen, because their manager Alex Nouri had been under immense pressure ahead of facing Mainz. They went to Mainz at the weekend. Bremen had lost four in a row, but in their defence, that run included Gladbach, Dortmund and Bayern since the turn of the year. I mean, Chris, they're a huge club, aren't they, Werder Bremen?
Yeah, I commentated on one of their winter break games in Marbella, because Nouri took over this season. Is that correct?
Yeah, from Skripnik, yeah.
Exactly. So, and it just doesn't seem particularly happy camp. That Thomas Delaney got one of those goals. I think he's an excellent signing from Copenhagen. Frank Baumann's new as sporting director as well. So I think I'm all right in saying he said they're already looking for a new head coach, or looking at the head coach next season, but clearly he's now being judged upon his performances. So they look in a bit of a pickle, Bremen. I guess those 16 or million years under Thomas Schaff have probably made it more difficult for everybody else to come in since, and to try and, because you're sort of always under that, you know, judged by how good he was and how long he was there for.
Yeah, absolutely. If they hadn't signed Serge Gnabry for his goals, I don't know where they'd be this season. Currently 16th, that is the relegation playoff spot in Germany. So Bremen's still very much in trouble. A couple of other headlines from Germany. Dieter Hecking has lost his second game as Gladbach boss, so beaten by Fiorentina in the week, and they lost 2-1 to RB Leipzig. Lovely goal from Emil Forsberg and an assist from him. So Leipzig stay within touching distance of Bayern, who got a 96th minute equaliser past the 5th minute of added time that was allocated. And Rune Jahrstein, the Hertha goalkeeper, when the ball went in the back of the net from Lewandowski, picked it up and just booted it into Xabi Alonso's back. And I think he might face a suspension. But typical Bayern, Chris.
Yes, that's the old adage, if you're not playing well, just make sure you don't lose. You don't know how important that point will be. We talked about winners with Ibrahimovic. They have plenty, Bayern, don't they? And Lewandowski is one, you know. That point might be the difference between them and Leipzig. It probably won't be, but it's, you know, just don't lose. But a bit of a come down. They were so good in that second half against Arsenal. Again, maybe having reached that peak, they were just slightly off it against Hertha. You can understand why the goalkeeper was a bit annoyed, because Hertha have been on a slight downward spiral after such a wonderful season. That would have been a huge win for them. But yeah, you can't knock Bayern. They just carry on going, don't they?
They certainly do. Top by 5 points, Leipzig second, and Dortmund third now, but 13 points behind Bayern. Let's turn our attention now to Russia and Turkey.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.
Okay, joining us now is football journalist and Turkish football expert, Elliot Rothwell. Elliot, thanks for coming on the podcast.
No problem. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you back on, mate, because it's been a while. And there's a couple of things we want to talk to you about. The Russian League is going to get back underway shortly. But let's talk about Turkey and the title race in Turkey. Now, for people who haven't been following, what's the situation with the title race and why is it slightly unusual, I think it'd be fair to say, between the two top teams in the league this season?
Yeah, well, for most part of the season, the league has been led by Istanbul Başakşehir here, who have really come from not nowhere. They're state-funded. They were linked to a state water conglomerate. They changed the name from Istanbul Büyükşehir Belediyesi, which means kind of Istanbul Municipal Council, a few years ago. And really, they've gone from strength to strength. I mean, they've got quite a good a few good players. They didn't until January really have any people that you would call stars in terms of European football, what many people would know. They've got Emre Belözoğlu, who obviously used to play for Newcastle, Valencia, Inter. They signed Adebayor after his performances at the Africa Cup of Nations. He was obviously on a free transfer to leaving Palace. And they signed Junior Caichara from Schalke, who was kind of the only one really of the signings in January that has really gone on to be a permanent fixture in the side. The rest of them are really players that are making their name this season. Yeah, there aren't that many stars there, but they've just put together this team that's really effective kind of on the counter-attack. They play quite direct. They've got enough quality up front and around then. They kind of stick it up to the big man Mehmet Bakdal up front and kind of play things off him and allow the three kind of in the 4-2-3-1, the three behind the striker to just buzz around and they're quite effective. But since the last couple of weeks, really, Beşiktaş have really kind of pulled away. Başakşehir dropped points again this weekend while Beşiktaş won, and now the gap is 4 points. So it doesn't look like they'll be able to claw it back, but it's still been a remarkable season, whatever happens.
Obviously, people would have seen that Mario Gomez left Beşiktaş, and he was a big factor in them winning the title last season and getting into the Champions League. But they're top now by 4 points, and I'm looking at their options going forward. I mean, Demba Ba's back in the country as well, I've seen with the club, and they seem to have good attacking options. I suppose it's Cenk Tosun who sort of bizarrely has come to form of late.
Yeah, he's the one who's really come to the fore and the one that's really stood up to be counted since Mario Gomez left. You mentioned Demba Ba. He's not actually played yet. He's still suffering from that horrendous injury that kind of went viral a few months ago.
Yeah.
That leg break. He's still out. So they signed him on loan without him being fit, which is a bit of a gamble, but I think obviously they know the player knows the club. I think it's quite a comfortable fit. They've also signed Ryan Babel, who's featured quite a lot since he signed, but he's not really set the world alight yet. And then they've got Vincent Aboubakar, who obviously scored the winning goal for Cameroon at the Cup of Nations. He hasn't really come off all that well. Sometimes they've played him up front and put Tosun on the right with his left foot cutting inside and then had Quaresma on the left. But really, since they've signed Babel, it's Babel on the left, Quaresma on the right and Tosun up front. And Aboubakar's kind of struggled to get back into the side since he went on duty with Cameroon. But yeah, they're strong all the way throughout the side. They really do have probably the best squad in the league, especially with Fenerbahce and Galatasaray struggling at the minute.
Yeah, Quaresma, Talisca, who's scored goals there since he arrived from Portugal. Gökhan Inler on the books of Beşiktaş as well. Things haven't worked out for Galatasaray yet, and they've changed their manager.
Yeah, they've appointed Iga Tudor, obviously the kind of former Juventus central defensive midfielder or centre-back, Croatian international. I think he was part of that 1998 World Cup squad. It was a bit of a surprise, really, that he ended up at Karabükspor after... That's who they've just appointed from. They've poached him from Karabükspor, who are 10th in the league after being promoted last season. And he took over. He didn't get them promoted, but then took over. He was at Pauk last season, and he'd been at Hajduk Split. And I don't think he'd really shown much promise as a manager in his managerial career before then. But at Karabükspor, he did really well. That they're third in the league in terms of their home form. They've really made it a fortress out in Karabük. It's the proverbial kind of hard place to go. And he's now taken over at Galatasaray. Jan Oda Rekerink left after not doing too much of a bad job. They don't really have the squad anymore, Galatasaray. They've still got Schneider, they've still got Podolski, but when really your main forward is Eren Derdiok, who they signed from Kasımpaşa, it's not really a title-winning side, especially the way that Beşiktaş now look. And they were really unlucky to not get through in the Champions League, I think. So that's what Galatasaray are up against there. Their squad, I mean, you can just flick through the names that are there, but they're not much special. Martin Linnes, right back, Hakan Balta, Semih Kaya. That they've just not got that many good players. Schneider's probably the only quality player. Selçuk İnan, who's been the captain and kind of the defensive midfielder, like Pirlo type role, he's on the way out, on the way down. They just don't have that many good players. And I think it's going to take some massive restructuring and massive reinvestment in the summer, which might not come, for Tudor to really do what needs to be done and revamp that squad.
Well, let's talk about a team that are doing well after what was a disappointing start to the season. And it's a team led from the front by another veteran. I mean, you mentioned Schneider there, who was part of that Inter team that won the Champions League with Samuel Eto'o, who is still scoring goals in Turkey and helping his team climb the table. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, this is really one of the stories, one of the form sides that are left in the league, because the manager Riza Jalimbay, he took over, I think, in it was before Christmas, maybe September, around that period, and since then, they've been the form team in the league. Really, they're in the bottom three. It looked like they might get relegated. It looked like they've got a lot of Brazilian expats there. They've got Eto. They've got some name players. They've also signed Sandro in January, but it looked like they weren't that bothered anymore. It looked like they'd gone out there for one more payday, and that was it. After a good season last season, it looked like they'd kind of given up. But since Chelimbe's taken over, they've really just been a revelation. They're now up to fifth, and they're just 2 points behind Fenerbahce and 5 points behind Galatasaray. So if they could get into the Europa League, that would be a huge achievement, especially if it was at the expense of Fenerbahce. And as I said, they've signed Sandro. He's not really made his way into the team yet because they've got Chico, who's been playing there. He's been playing brilliantly. They've got Danilo Yektakurtulus, who Galatasaray fans will know, who wasn't particularly great there. But it's really clicked for them since the new manager came in.
I know, Elliot, as well, you closely follow what happens in the Russian Premier League, much like me and Chris. And I wanted to ask you about Spartak. The season gets back underway on March the 3rd. They're 5 points clear with 13 games to go. They've had so much turmoil at the Moscow club over the years. Do you think they can see out that title challenge and hold off the likes of Zenit, who are pushing them?
It's really hard to say, I think, because obviously they're top at the minute and they've got probably the best player in the league in Quincy Promes at the club. They've also signed Luis Adriano from AC Milan, who I think is a really good signing up front, and probably will work in tandem with Zay Luis, who's always also there. But Zenit as well have gone out and signed. Obviously, they've got Branislav Ivanovic, which English fans will know, but they've signed a couple of other players, and it looks like they're really making a go for it now. They're only 5 points behind. Mircea Lucescu obviously knows how to win a league and how to prepare a team to win a league. But you mentioned that game against CSK. CSK have got a new manager, obviously, after Leonid Slutsky left, really kind of just before the winter break. They've got Viktor Goncharenko, who was the young manager at Bate Borisov when they first kind of came onto the scene in the Champions League. He's a talented coach. He was assistant at CSK under Slutsky for a while, and now he's the head coach. And they'll want to show that they're not done yet in this title race. And so that game against Zenit will be huge. And if Spartak win in that round of fixtures, they'll then be kind of 8 points clear, and it'll be really hard to hold them back then, because the firepower that they've got going forward means that they can basically fire away any team. The defence isn't as strong as Zenit's maybe is, but what they've got going forward is really useful. And I want to say they'll do it, but it's so hard, difficult to say.
It certainly is. They go to Krasnodar on the first weekend back of the Russian Premier League, who, after a great start, sort of fell away a little bit in terms of the title race. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Elliot, was, and I have not seen it yet, the BBC have done a documentary about Russian hooligans and in the lead up to the World Cup in Russia in 2018. Now, I really want to go. Chris and I both want to go to the World Cup in Russia. But I think people are nervous, and maybe there's been a bit of fear-mongering about the potential, after what happened in Marseille, especially last year with the England and Russia fans, about going to the country. What are your views on how safe the tournament will be from a fan perspective and that documentary?
From a fan perspective, to go to the tournament, I think it would be a great tournament. The only problem, obviously, would be the distances between host cities if you wanted to go to a few different ones. I think that the Russian police, the OMON, they're called, the kind of riot police, the geared up, tooled up police that they'll have there will keep a lot of the trouble at bay. There was an incident in 2010 in Manezhnaya Square, which is just underneath kind of the walls of the Kremlin, that after a Spartak Moscow fan was killed, he was also a member of kind of some ultra-nationalist right-wing groups. A number of fans and people linked to football clubs throughout Moscow protested, and there was a bit of ethnic violence there. They were charged with hitting and throwing things at anybody of what they described as a non-white Russian appearance, anybody that was walking past the square. But since then, that was seen as a huge defeat for OMON, this right police force. And since then, they've really stepped up their game. And I think that they'll be the ones who are kind of in charge of what happens in terms of fan relations. In terms of this documentary, I think there's a number of things, problems with it, really. First of all, it's completely legitimate and completely useful to go to see these guys, these Oriol Butchers who were involved in the trouble in Marseille with England fans in Euro 2016. That's fine. And it's a story that needs telling. But I think what the problem was that there was no contextualizing of what the place of this in wider Russian football fan culture. They went to see the most extreme examples and they found them, but they didn't say this is just a part of it. They went to see the game, I think it was Spartak against CSKA, which is one of the kind of the most leery games that you could go and see. They could have gone and seen a bog standard Premier League game against Ufa against Krylia Sovetov, and it'd have been the main thing. The main thing that they'd have taken from that is that there's nobody here. Never mind any trouble, there'd be nobody there. Yeah. So obviously it from an editorial perspective, you need to go and find out the stories, and they found the story, but there was no contextualizing of it. And I think one of the things that really struck me was that one of these guys, these Oriol Butchers, mentioned Luton, and the narrator who was there was really baffled by why this guy had mentioned Luton. And it really struck me that the reason that these guys know what Luton is and where Luton is and what Luton are famous for is exactly the reason that everybody in England watching this documentary now knows where Oriol is. It's the same, like,
right.
It's been constructed in the same way, and Luton are these crazy guys, just the same way that we're now seeing Oriol as these crazy guys, which is why English football has still got this reputation in Russia as being really violently fan-driven, fighting.
It still exists in a few countries, I think, as well. Yeah. Even you speak to fans in Germany, and they don't think it's like it was in the 80s, but there's still a perception that England is almost the Mecca, or not the Mecca, but you know what I mean? Like the main place where hooliganism, obviously, I suppose there's a good reason for that, but it's still the home of hooliganism or something, or it's a badge of honour, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the issues and one of the reasons that is because we obviously, in the UK, we produce a lot of film and a lot of television about hooliganism. And one of the things that I thought of when I was watching this thing is that if you were a non-English person who didn't really know much about English football and you watched Danny Dyer's Real Football Factories when he goes to Manchester or Birmingham, that was the only context that you had for what English football fans looked like, you would think that this is what English football is still like. And it sort of was like that, but the Russian equivalent. So a lot of people who watch this will now think that this is what the whole of Russian football culture is like. Just as if you were a Russian watching Danny Dyer's Real Football Factories, you might think that that is what football in London or Manchester or Birmingham or Liverpool is really like. And it's not the case. It's not the general experience of football in that country.
Elliot, really great to get you on. Really interesting thoughts as well on that. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And will you come back on before the end of the season to talk about Turkey and Russia again?
Of course. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
And a big thanks to Elliot for coming on the podcast. As always, Chris Parrott is with me. Chris, Gareth Bale is back from his injury list, taught La Liga, and that's a big boost for Real Madrid.
Huge boost. First appearance since the 22nd of November, which is a long time, isn't it? 3 months, basically. Came on. In the second half against Espanyol, Madrid were 1-0 up, and 12 minutes later he scored. And it was Bale, just so typical. Played in, had the pace to get there beyond the defender, and then just fired it across the goalkeeper, which was a brilliant finish. And I just wonder, he was very close to being ready for the Napoli game. He trained before that match, but Zidane chose not to pick him. And I guess they just wrap him slightly in cotton wool because he has had so many of these muscle injuries, hasn't he? I think if that was the Champions League final, Bale might have played against Napoli, but there's no need to rush him back. And a 2-0 win means Madrid maintain top position with games in hand over Barcelona. And they're in action this week on Wednesday at Valencia. Games should have taken place in December, but they were away at the Club World Cup. So they have one of their games in hand is away at Valencia, which should be a really good game. And I think they've got Villarreal away at the weekend. So quite a big week for Zidane's side.
And they're coming up against a Valencia side who maybe, after all the turmoil and the managers, have found some rhythm.
Yeah, I watched their game. They beat Athletic Bilbao 2-0. First half in particular, they look really assured, quite confident, not like the Valencia that we've seen for most of this season. They're even cheered off at the Mestalla, which hasn't happened for a long time. Yeah, 15th in the table, 7 points clear of the drop zone. Zaza scored a really nice goal, really well worked, and then a nice disguised finish when he was 3-1 and 1. It just felt a bit more like Valencia, not quite of old, but you know, they have a lot of good players. I think Garay has improved them immeasurably defensively. It was a good performance, and poor old Bilbao was one of those days. They rested quite a lot of their players who had played in the Europa League in midweek against Apoel. They brought on Aritz Aderith in the second half. 2 minutes later, he pulled up with a leg injury. I'd be surprised if he's fit for their second leg against Apoel. And they'd made all three changes, so they had 10 men for the last 40 minutes.
I always like seeing Aderith back against his former club, Valencia. He normally does quite well against them. You mentioned there Kevin Gamero with his incredible hat-trick, his 4-minute, 43-second hat-trick, the quickest in La Liga, as Chris said, since 1995, in that 4-1 win over Sporting Gijón, and all those goals coming in the final 10 minutes of the game. Staggering. But we've got to talk about Barcelona, Chris, and what's been a very difficult week for them. They did beat Leganés 2-1 thanks to a late Lionel Messi goal on the weekend. But it's clear, in the aftermath of the Paris Saint-Germain defeat, that things are not well at the Camp Nou.
No. If Luis Enrique was hoping for a supportive homecoming, he didn't get one. There were songs in his support from some of the more hardcore vocal supporters who sit behind the goal. That was whistled by many others at the Nou Camp. Andre Gomez was subbed off for Iniesta later on in the game, and he got some fairly, you know, dog's abuse, loud jeering, loud boos. That's the nature of Barcelona, isn't it? It doesn't matter if you won the treble a couple of seasons ago. It was one of their worst performances in living memory, I think, in midweek, and the fans let them know about it. And I think it seems now, and this has always been in the background of are they playing the Barca way? You know, how, you know, Cruyff first set them up and then Guardiola, you know, totally dominating possession, because they don't do that anymore. And it was very successful, or has been very successful, but this season, things not going according to plan. And it brings me back, do you remember right at the start of Luis Enrique's reign? They didn't start very well.
Until Luis Suarez was over that suspension from the World Cup.
Yeah, and there was talk then of the fans, like, this isn't how Barcelona should be playing. And of course, it was all fine because they won the treble that season. Mm. They're not going to win the treble this campaign, I don't think. They still could. Barcelona doesn't seem a particularly happy place. Luis Enrique doesn't seem particularly content. I don't know. I feel right now that I'd be surprised if he was there at the start of next season. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think this is probably coming to the end for Luis Enrique. And he's always a coach who's talked about, you know, managers should just be on rolling your contracts. And if you do well, you keep your job. That's sort of his philosophy on it, which makes me think, look, this season's going badly. They're going out in the Champions League before the quarterfinal stage for the first time in a decade. And it just feels like maybe, you know, it's probably a bit extreme. The fan reaction is going to be extreme when the standards are so high. But I think his time's coming up. How about this one, Chris? How about Wenger to Barcelona for a year?
Oh, now you're talking.
Could you see it? Because he said,
I'd be very surprised. I would think they would go for maybe Jorge Sampaoli. I think he'd be favourite to get the job. I think Barcelona fans like the way his team play. They love his passion. I think he would be a nice fit. I think Lionel Messi has said some nice things about him in the past, which always helps. I don't think they'd go for Wenger. I think they'd go for a younger coach, personally.
I don't know. I'm sort of, the more I think about it, the more I like it. And Wenger says whatever happens, regardless of whether he's at Arsenal or not next season, he will be managing somewhere.
He's coming to Ipswich. Have you not heard the news?
To replace Mick?
Yeah, to replace Mick, yeah. He fancies one last hurrah in the Championship.
Chris, we're almost at the end of the podcast. Quick one, the Italian title race. Juve roll on.
They won again. The top seven all won. And last week, it was something similar as well. It's been a great week for all the big boys in Italian football. There was an interesting tete-a-tete on the touchline there between Bonucci and Allegri. Reports on Monday that he's going to be fined for it. They exchanged some angry words.
This was during the 4-1 win over Palermo.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was any, you know, footballers are supposed to be passionate, aren't they? And particularly Italians, I guess. And because the gaze of the world's media is on it, all of a sudden every bust up becomes a story. But yeah, there's plenty of passion, which I guess Juve fans would be happy. We talked about how they don't seem to lose that winning mentality that maybe Paris Saint-Germain have, given they've dominated Serie A for as long as PSG have. Dybala with two, Higuain on the score sheet. And you feel like their season starts this week. Champions League, Porto, they've all talked about maybe winning it this season or at some stage in the very near future. This feels like their opportunity. So I think we can properly assess Max Allegri's team maybe after the two legs against Porto. But just elsewhere, Roma, 7 points behind Juve, they remain. They beat Torino at home 4-1. And I think you picked up on some analysis of Joe Hart in that defeat.
Yeah, so James Horncastle, Italian football expert on BT, point out that Joe Hart was beaten low to his left every single goal that Roma scored, almost like they were targeting that.
Very interesting.
So, you know, that's a concern. And if we think back to, we were both in Lons together, funnily enough, for England-Wales, weren't we, at the game when Gareth Bale beat him down that side.
With yeah, it's true.
Free kick that he should have stopped. I wonder, you know, I'm sure people have written about that, you know, people into the analytics and everything, but certainly a concern for the man who's been linked with big clubs in England again, but with Liverpool and everything once his loan at Torino comes to an end. Gabigol, by the way, got his first goal for Inter at last in a 1-0 win over Bologna. I saw a bit of this game, really scrappy in the end, but he'll be relieved because it has not worked out for him there. Napoli with a 3-1 win at Chievo. After they were beaten by Real Madrid in the Champions League. That wonderful goal from Insigne. League this week, Chris. Give me your thoughts on Leicester and Manchester City's prospects of getting results in their first leg. City host Monaco and Leicester go to Seville.
Yeah, just quickly, forgot to mention Milik. He came on for the last 19 minutes in that.
So he's back,
yeah. And he definitely will be for the second leg.
So Bale and Milik back for the second leg. That's not bad.
It's not bad, no. I'd be shocked if Leicester get anything. You know, I know there's been this fairy tale in the Champions League. I think they're coming up against significantly better opposition than Bruges, Porto or Copenhagen. I think it's one of the toughest ties they could have got, in all honesty, because Sevilla will have that hunger. They haven't been at this stage of the Champions League for a long time themselves. And I think they're a top team, Sevilla, and I think they will beat Leicester. And I think Leicester's best. I do fear for them slightly this week, and they just have to try and stay in the tie if they can. But whatever, they'll have a brilliant time. I know a few Leicester fans who are going. It'd probably be about 25 degrees in Sevilla. It'll be a great occasion, but I think they will struggle. I'm fascinated to see how Man City play against Monaco. I think they've improved recently. I hope Monaco go for it. I mean, go for them in terms of attack. Leonardo Jardim is a master tactician. I think it's a really, really exciting tie. And I can't wait to see how Monaco's young guns go up against some of the most expensive players in the world, because they'll probably be some of the most expensive players in the world maybe next summer.
Yeah, one of those guys might well be wearing a Manchester City shirt next season.
Absolutely. I think it's they're playing for a big side, earning lots of money. And we've talked about Monaco and the taxes there, but it does feel like an audition for a lot of them on the biggest stage. And you know what the English press will be like, because they won't have seen them play. And if they play well, all of a sudden it will be, you know, who is Mbappe, who is Silva, who's Bakayoko. I think it's a big week for Monaco and their players.
They took Spurs apart twice. Will they do the same to Manchester City? It looks like United are going through in their Europa League tie, of course, with that big home win against Saint-Etienne. Spurs with some work to do, certainly, against Ghent. Chris, that's all we have time for. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, have you?
Yes, it's always a bit strange over Skype.
We don't have the same chemistry, eh?
Oh, we do, Rob, always. One thing I meant to say about the Europa League. You might be surprised, or people be surprised, that Manchester United are playing on Wednesday. That is because Lyon play at home on Thursday. And UEFA rules stipulate that those two clubs can't play on the same night at home. And it's the reason as well that Fenerbahce are playing on Wednesday, because Besiktas play on Thursday. And that's maybe more understandable that you can't have two Istanbul giants playing at home on the same night in Europe.
Chris, we've got to tell the listeners there's no show on next Monday.
We're jet setting. I'm in America and you're in Germany.
I'm going to the world famous Carnival to get...
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I think it's going to be absolutely ridiculous. I need to pick a fancy dress. In fact, if people want to help me pick what I should go as, at FIU Podcast, because the whole city wears fancy dress and no one goes to work on Monday and everyone just drinks themselves into an oblivion. So I need a fancy dress suggestion. Fancy dress I've not done in years.
What you could go as Jurgen Klopp.
Oh, that's quite good.
Get some stilts, get some glasses.
Do you mean stilts?
Well, he's about 9 foot.
Well, get a Dortmund trackie and get a little side party going. Yeah,
And you might hit the news. And then get someone to like take a picture and like, Jurgen Klopp's back in Cologne. And that will get the rumour mill going.
I mean, I look absolutely nothing like him. I'm ginger for starters, so that's not going to... All right, so, no show next Monday. We're sorry about that. Maybe we'll chuck something out on iTunes at some point over the course of that week. But, thank you very much for listening. As always, please leave us a review on iTunes and tweet us at FIE Podcast.
This is Football in Europe.